Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, citizens of the world advocating for racial justice and an end to discrimination in all its forms in the United Kingdom. And Supper at Emmaus. Father Peter Stravinskas reflects on why Christ hid his identity from his disciples soon after his resurrection. Kayetezi survived the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. The Tutsis, she says, were not considered to be human beings. Genocide is the result of a very long process of dehumanization. The genocide, she said, was the final result of discrimination. Genocide in Rwanda and the kind of ethnic cleansing we saw at the turn of the millennium in the Balkans stemmed from discrimination, a failure to know and accept one's neighbor. Reaction, too, to the growing tide of immigrants to Europe, to the United States, is full of fear and a fundamental lack of knowledge or understanding of the stranger in our midst. This April, Pope Benedict XVI appealed for an end to racism, saying resolute and concrete action is needed on both the national and international levels to prevent and eliminate every form of discrimination and intolerance. He pointed to education and to the church as playing important roles in exalting the dignity of the human person. Well, in the United Kingdom, the Catholic Association for Racial Justice, or CARJ, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, campaigning for an end to discrimination of all forms. I spoke to National Coordinator Cecilia Taylor Camara and to Rosie Bearwall on the committee for this year's celebrations. She explains what we should be remembering when we talk about racial discrimination.
I think it's quite important to remember that racism still is a problem, both internationally and in the UK. If you look at the statistics that are available from the government, we still find that there is quite a high degree of racial inequality in areas such as employment, educational achievement, access to public services, to the extent that many people in black communities, especially older people in black communities, find it difficult to actually access healthcare and actually have much higher rates of illness compared to the white population, for example, in the UK. So I think it's actually quite important to remember this issue hasn't actually gone away. It's still very much an issue which is a problem for many communities and needs to be tackled. So it shouldn't actually be an issue which is taken off the agenda.
Now, Cecilia, the Catholic Association for Racial Justice is celebrating, I know, its 25th anniversary this year. You're launching a campaign called The Changing Face of Britain. Tell me more about that and the significance and the progress that you've made over these past 25 years.
The 25th anniversary program of CARJ this year is a program that is designed to actually listen to what the parishes are saying to us. Throughout the year, CARJ is organising a programme of local events culminating in a national celebration at Westminster Cathedral on the 7th of November. Hopefully we'll have the new Archbishop of Westminster as the chief celebrant. The Changing Face of Britain programme is celebrating the way the church and society have changed for the better over 25 years, attempting to read the signs of the times and discerning in our new situation the challenge we are called to address in the future.
Now, Rosie, do I understand correctly that you have had personal experience in of discrimination there in the UK?
I have, yes. I was actually born in the UK, but as a child, both myself and my family faced quite a lot of discrimination, and that included being called names while I was walking down the street, and both my parents also, you know, faced name calling also.
Where is your family from originally?
My family originally is from India. Mm-hmm. Both my parents come from India. I was actually born here in the UK, but because my skin colour is brown, obviously I'm very, you know, I'm easily identifiable as being different to a white person. And so as a result of that, I did actually face quite a lot of hostility when I was growing up. And that included not just name calling, but also different members of the family actually the subject of physical attack.
How did that make you and your family feel?
It made us feel very vulnerable. It made us feel that we weren't very secure, and it also made us ask lots of questions about what was going on in the minds of the people that were actually carrying out the attacks. For some reason, they believed that it was actually acceptable to take out their anger and their lack of understanding on others just because of a difference in skin colour.
Let me just tell you my personal story. I just want you to know I'm blonde and I look like I'm American and all, you know, all around American or maybe a Northern European. But a few years back, about the time when Italy was receiving boatloads of thousands of Albanian refugees who were fleeing the conflict in Kosovo, I had an Italian man come up to me as I was walking my dog in the park, and he told me really angrily, "Go back to where you came from." And I don't know if he thought I was Albanian or not, but I have to admit it was the first time here in Europe that I've been the target of racial or ethnic discrimination. How closely linked are these two, racism or xenophobia or ethnic discrimination?
I would say they're very closely linked indeed. I mean, if you listen to what the Vatican has to say about the sin of racism, it actually stems from a belief that somehow one group is trying to assert its dominance over another group of people just on the basis of skin colour. And so they are very linked, because there's this intrinsic idea that in some way one group is more valuable than another group. One group is superior. One group has a right to dominate another group. But actually, we are all equal human beings, equal in the sight of God. We may have, very different economic power sometimes. Migrants often don't have a lot of economic power, and asylum seekers and refugees have even less. But that's not to say that we shouldn't respect someone's humanity, their basic humanity, just because they are different, and treat them less accordingly.
Now, we saw, for example, that racial discrimination in the United States led to waves of violence, the creation of criminal organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, the terrorist group the Black Panthers back in the 50s and 60s. Now, Britain is coming to terms with a rise in homegrown Islamic extremism. Do you think that partly to blame for this is this an inherent or an underlying discrimination against foreign communities in Britain? And at what point does discrimination lead to violence?
Well, in the British society, discrimination has always been part of society. And over the years, the church has actually taken the lead in trying to work for a more just society. The very fact that the church is concerned enough to set up an agency like CARJ that is committed to the work of racial justice. CARJ was actually established to support Black and Asian communities, to work with people from all backgrounds, to challenge racial injustice and discrimination both at individual and institutional levels, and also to be able to promote equality of opportunity. Now, although overt discrimination has been banned from society, there are still challenges that we know we have to live with, like Muslims in the British society, some of who have been born here and who live with us and who are visible And sometimes it's just the insecurity of individuals that, you know, that prompts them to be racist towards other people. Because as Rosie rightly pointed out, before God, we are all the same. And increasingly people are coming to terms with that. The United States is taking the lead. And even with President Barack Obama's election victory, that has actually raised the confidence and the profile of minority ethnic groups who were saying that if it has happened in the United States, there's a possibility that it could happen in the UK, although the political system may not allow that to happen. That remains to be seen. And in addition, if we can have somebody who really embraces and brings all this diversity together in a united front, Britain could be following America.
In addition, I'd say that in the UK, as a result of the terrorist attacks in America on 9/11 and also in the UK on 7/7, since those attacks, the Muslim community has faced a lot more hostility and prejudice as a result. People don't seem to understand that it's only a small minority of people that actually carried out these attacks, and that the whole of the community can't be blamed because of the actions of a small minority. Now, the press actually have to, you know, take responsibility here, I believe, because often the reporting is not as measured and, you know, as considered as it should be. They should make it very plain, the fact that the majority of Muslims in this country are law-abiding citizens. Having said that, I think it's also important to remember that within the Muslim community itself, we have to remember they do face higher levels of discrimination and also inequality compared to other groups, for example, compared to the Indian community. And so even if a Muslim young man has got a degree, he's less likely to be employed in a graduate job. And in fact, in the Muslim community, there's a high incidence of people actually having degrees and actually having to work as taxi drivers just to earn a living. And so the host community also needs to ask itself, what can we actually do to help Muslims integrate into society? Muslims themselves would have an obligation to integrate, but the host community itself also has an obligation to, you know, to reach out its hand in friendship and to build bridges to the Muslim community, because they are an integral part of this country.
Well, that, in fact, leads me on to my next question. Now, the UK has one of the biggest, most interracial societies, perhaps in all of Europe. How effectively would you say immigrants are being integrated today? And what are some of the biggest policy gaps that need to be filled?
The integration of the migrant community in the UK as a centre of the work that we do, and also the policies that have been laid out by government. Well, one of the ways in which a migrant community is being integrated or should be integrated is through education. A lot of migrant communities here come for the opportunity to improve their lives, to have a better way of living. And the categories of new migrants, asylum seekers and refugees are some of the people who have the most difficult challenges, and policies that can actually weave them into the British society are still lacking. And efforts have been made to make sure that migrants are actually integrated into the community. Among those, we have the Dalits of the South Asian communities. And as well as that, gypsies and travellers also make up this group of migrants. And a more comprehensive policy is yet to be actually drawn up, both by government and hopefully by agencies that work with migrants.
I mean, you mentioned education, access to more employment opportunities, to public services. What are some of the things that the government, perhaps even with the church communities, can actually do to integrate these people more fully?
One area in particular is the issue of how to deal with refused asylum seekers and the undocumented migrants that are actually in the UK at the moment. It's estimated that there are about 500,000 of them. Many of these people have been here for a number of years, even 10 to 15 years. And there's a question about how we should treat these people, because at the moment, if you're a refused asylum seeker, you're not actually allowed to work in the UK. And there is a proposal which the Mayor of London actually supports, and that many refugee groups actually have proposed and are fighting for, to actually get the government to actually grant an amnesty to undocumented migrants and refused asylum seekers are still in this country. And the reason is that many of them actually don't want to go back to their home countries because they do genuinely face persecution in those countries. And if they are allowed to stay here and also to work, then they would actually be able to contribute in taxation to the country and to help build up the community. At the moment, many of them are forced to work in the black market and not able to therefore contribute their taxes to actually help the country in that way.
However, what do you say to the British factory worker, or, you know, or even the French builder or the Italian builder who blames foreigners for taking his job away, especially in these difficult economic times?
If we look at the statistics, I don't think that's actually borne out by the reality of the statistics themselves, because what you find is that migrants come to the UK often to do the jobs that people that have been born and brought up here for some reason are not prepared to do, because the wage rates are not at the level that they would like, or that they actually see some jobs such as cleaning as being possibly, you know, beneath what they would like to do. And so migrants actually come in to actually perform a very valuable service to our community. And in fact, you know, I would go so far as to suggest the country couldn't actually run without them. And in fact, the impact of the economic downturn would have been much worse had we not had the migrants here.
Just to round up everything now, we've mentioned that the church has been working to eliminate racial injustice, but what more can be done? What sort of hope can we have that this plague, if you will disappear one day from our societies? Because it's certainly not limited to Britain. It's not limited to Italy. I've been in the Middle East and in Africa, and as a white person, I felt it over there as well. So how are we going to get rid of racial discrimination on a global level?
On a global level, I think people have to come to terms with the fact that boundaries have been broken by globalization. The world has become a smaller place, and nobody's going to stop movement of people. People have always been on the move, and nobody's going to halt the movement of people from one part of the world to the other. With host communities coming to terms with this, with the newcomers coming to terms and being willing to integrate so that our lives are fulfilled alongside each other, there's so much to celebrate in our diversity. I mean, CARJ, for example, gives us the opportunity during on Racial Justice Sunday to celebrate the diversity of our community in what we want to build to be a very truly inclusive church and a truly inclusive society. Promoting racial justice, even from schools right up to university, is very crucial, because knowledge is wealth. And the lack of knowledge is clearly one of the reasons why people form these prejudices. Because when people come to know you and understand you, it's much easier than when they have no knowledge of you. We are all citizens of the world.
I would just add that I believe that governments can do a lot more to actually promote racial harmony and racial justice. And also, you know, the church itself has a very important role to do as much as it can to actually promote racial justice, also both within the church, within its structures, and also within wider society. And the church, you know, can take a lead on that and even hold the government to account where the government isn't doing all that it could do to actually promote racial justice within the community.
Thanks there to Rosie Bayer-Wall and Cecilia Taylor-Kamara of the Catholic Association for Racial Justice. The story of Christ's empty tomb spread like wildfire throughout Jerusalem. It was the day Mary Magdalene ran to tell Simon Peter and John that Jesus' body was no longer there. 3 days had passed since his crucifixion on Mount Calvary, and some of his disciples had dispersed out of fear they might be next to face the executioner. In his Gospel, St. Luke recounts the tale of two disciples on the road to Emmaus, a village not far from Jerusalem. On their way, they meet a stranger who turns out to be Jesus himself. While no one knows for sure where the biblical Emmaus is in present-day Israel or the West Bank, scholars have indicated at least three or even more villages that may fit the description of the town and its location between 7 and 20 miles from Jerusalem.
Nonetheless, the gospel story is central to Christian belief in the resurrection and the Eucharistic sacrifice. In the Catholic Church, Emmaus has been named a titular see. Well, to understand the story more fully, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us on that dusty road to Emmaus for Jesus' encounter with his disciples.
As you recall, on Easter night, our Lord encounters two disciples hightailing it out of Jerusalem. Clearly, they think the show is over, and what happened to the Master, they don't want to happen to them, so they're getting out of the line of fire. And they're encountered on the road by a stranger. I should note that this is one of my favorite passages in the New Testament. In fact, I wrote my master's thesis in theology on this passage. But this stranger encounters them, and as happens frequently in these post-resurrection appearances, it turns out to be the risen Lord. And for some reason, they're not able to perceive him clearly for who he is. Obviously, he has a changed appearance, a transformed, a transfigured, glorified body. There's continuity between his previous earthly existence and now his risen life, but there are also points of discontinuity. The points of continuity, of course, it's a real body, because for apologetical reasons, the evangelists tell us he ate and he drank and he spoke and he walked and so forth. So it's a real body. And interestingly enough, even in that risen body, he bears the wounds of his crucifixion. And we can come back to that in another moment. That's not directly related to the Emmaus story. At the same time, there's discontinuity. He's able to pop in and out of places at will. And for one reason or another, he's not clearly identifiable by facial features. Mary Magdalene, we remember, recognizes him by his voice. In this episode, St. Luke says the disciples were kept from recognizing him. And they start to chat. And he said, "You look downcast. What's the problem?" "Well, you know, are you the only man in Jerusalem who hasn't heard what's gone on there these past couple of days?" "What things?" And they tell him what has happened, and then he proceeds to explain all of the Old Testament scriptures to them that refer to the passion and death of the Messiah. And they're intrigued by this, and they're approaching an inn, at which point they invite him to come in with them. Why? Because they want the conversation to keep going. Somehow or other, what he has said has sparked hope in them. Or rekindled hope, perhaps, is better. And then he sits down at a table with them, and we're told by Luke that he took the bread, blessed it, and broke it. Now, we hearing those words today immediately think we're at Mass. The early Christians, of course, were also using the exact same formula. And it says, in that instant, they recognized him. And then Luke says something very, very strange, and he disappeared from their sight. Well, what's gone on here? Well, as a matter of fact, what we've had is a reenactment of the Mass. The first half, the Liturgy of the Word, this stranger, who turns out to be the Lord, has opened up for them his sacred word, and he's explained it to them. Well, that's what happens in the first half of every Mass. In the second part, they sit down, and he breaks bread, blesses it, gives it to them. In that moment, they recognize him and he vanishes. Why? Because having the Eucharistic Christ, one does not need the historical Christ. It's fulfilled in the sacramental moment. And then they go back and they give this information to the disciples. And it's a very touching and a somewhat amusing situation at the same time. They say, they're getting ready to say that the Lord has been raised, and they're greeted with, "The Lord has been raised. It's true. He has appeared to Simon." The evidence for the resurrection is not the appearance to the two disciples. It's not the appearance to Mary Magdalene. It's the appearance to Simon Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. Those apparitions of the risen Lord to Mary Magdalene, to the two disciples, or any others, are all good and wonderful, but they have to be validated by the Prince of the Apostles. And the appearance of Jesus to Simon gives validity to all those other experiences of the risen Christ. In some sense, this Emmaus story is a mini catechism. It gives us all of the essential information we need in one chapter of Luke's Gospel, chapter 24. And it's done through the medium, really, of a play. The actors are very, very real. They're palpable. And the message is incredibly inspiring. And it's a reminder to us that we who live 2,000 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus are no worse off than the apostles who walked and talked with him 2,000 years earlier. Because our access to the risen Christ is every bit as possible and real through the Holy Eucharist as was their experience of him as he walked the roads of Galilee.
But why would Jesus, why didn't he want them to recognize him from the beginning?
I suspect it's because he wants them to recognize him in the way that all Christians thereafter will have to recognize him, in the Eucharist. You know, he says to Mary Magdalene, "Don't touch me," because she's still focused on a very natural relationship with him.
She recognizes his voice.
Right. And then she reaches out to touch him. And he says, "Don't do that." Now, what we do find is, with St. Thomas a week later, he tells him to touch him. Of course, there's also the difference. Thomas is one of the 12. His access to Christ can be very, very different, and it would be the difference today between a layperson and a priest. There's a qualitative difference in the relationship, and we have to understand that that's part of the Lord's will for the church, the hierarchical structure of the church. But with Mary Magdalene, she perceives him as the risen Christ, but it's important that she try to put aside those natural connotations that she's had, which are not bad, but they're superseded. It's no different from what our Lord says when that woman in the crowd praises Our Lady and says, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that fed you." And he said, "Rather, those who hear the word of God and put it into practice." Nothing wrong with his relationship, his natural relationship with his mother. But that would be fulfilled in a much, much deeper relationship, which was not based on blood, but based on discipleship.
Father Peter Stravinskas is founder of the Priestly Society of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman and editor of The Catholic Response. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.